Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. This week we engage in yet another presidential election into the hands of the winner of which we entrust the most powerful nation in the world. 43 men have held the office of the presidency in American history with varying degrees of success. In 1948, historian Arthur Schlesinger Sr. attempted to measure their success and published his conclusions in Life magazine, setting the stage for the many presidential rankings of various kinds that have been published ever since. Our guest this week, Max Skidmore, offers us his thoughts on the pros and cons of presidential rankings in his own assessment of presidential performance. Later in the show, Bruce Ackerman tells us about a blunder made at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 that led to a bitterly contested presidential election in 1800 and a constitutional amendment so that it wouldn't happen again. And if you're still hungry for more, Fiona Beattie will tell us about one of the most comprehensive online sites available on the American presidency. But first, let's take a look at some history in the news. If you're studying up on presidential elections while eating a hamburger and topping it off with a banana split, you might be interested to know that both turned 100 this year. Although there are many contenders for the honor, St. Louis is claiming that the ground beef patty, at least as we know it, made its debut at the St. Louis World's Fair, as did the modern incarnation of the banana split. According to local reports, David Strickler, a soda jerk from Latrobe, Pennsylvania, sliced a banana lengthwise and topped it with three different scoops of ice cream and three flavors of syrup and sold them to the crowd for 10 cents. If you're also thinking about your investments and wondering whether the stock market does better under Democrats or Republicans, according to the authors of an article in the Journal of Finance, you should put your money on the Democrats. Using a broad index of stock prices, UCLA professors Pedro Santa Clara and Rosen Volkanoff found that the stock market between 1927 and 1998 returned about 11% more a year under the Democrats and 2% more under Republicans. Treasury bills also performed better under Democratic presidents, yielding a 5.3% higher return than the Republicans' 3.7%. The cause of the disparity, the authors had to admit, remains uncertain. And finally, who can forget the infamous Vote-O-Matic with its butterfly ballot from the 2000 Florida presidential election? Not the National Museum of American History, which has opened an exhibit with hanging chads as part of its history of voting in America. Vote, the Machinery of Democracy, highlights the evolution of voting techniques and technology. It shows how Americans have historically adopted improved voting techniques as a result of political, social, and technological changes, but are yet to come up with a foolproof way of measuring the will of the people. Vote at the National Museum of American History will close on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2005. Next up, a conversation with Max Skidmore on presidential performance. Bruce Ackerman's commentary on the bitterly contested presidential election of 1800, and Fiona Beattie's Site of the Week. This is Talking History. Popular writers know that to attract the attention of Americans, a list is always helpful. An assertion of the 10 best or top 100 of anything is likely to attract immediate attention. So writes our guest this week, Max Skidmore, to which he quickly adds, presidential rankings are no exception. And that's the subject of our conversation. Max Skidmore is Thomas Jefferson Professor and University of Missouri Curator's Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's the author of Presidential Performance, A Comprehensive Review, published by McFarland & Company. Welcome, Max.
Thank you.
Tell us, when was the first presidential ranking done?
Well, the first formal ranking was in 1948 in Life magazine.
And who did it?
Arthur Schlesinger Sr., the eminent historian.
And what methodology did he use?
He surveyed 55 presidential scholars, experts on the presidency.
The results?
The results. He asked them to place the presidents in five categories: great, near great, average, below average, and failure. And Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Franklin Roosevelt came out on top. Wilson came in fourth. Harding came in at the bottom.
Well, we'll see if that changed at all over the years. But tell us, what other presidential rankings have occurred since then, the major ones?
The major ones. Well, Schlesinger himself did another one in 1962, and his son Arthur Schlesinger Jr. did a fine one in 1996 for the New York Times magazine that was republished in Political Science Quarterly in 1997, and there were a number of rankings in between.
Give us some examples, especially those where the methodologies differed.
The methodologies have tended to become more sophisticated, or in Schlesinger Jr.'s terms, more pretentious, as political scientists got involved, more quantitative, more precise, with specific categories against which the presidents were measured and so forth.
Now, you mentioned, for example, the Murray and Blessing survey in 1982, I believe. How was that constructed?
Well, Murray and Blessing sent out 2,000 questionnaires to a number of people, historians, popular figures, and all that, and had 846 responses. Their methodology was so vague, they never did really describe what their methodology was. But they did do one interesting thing. At the end, they listed all of their participants, all of their respondents. And there were a few who were even eminent in their fields. Most of them were noted for their obscurity.
So they were looking for a sort of a quantitative approach, or as many figures having input as possible.
Yes. Sometimes the idea is that the more you have, the better the results will be.
Well, that's questionable, of course.
Indeed.
You seem to like Clinton Rossiter's. At least you call it classic and excellent.
It is classic, and it is excellent in the sense that it's thoughtful. It was Rossiter's own evaluation based upon his own not necessarily well-stated criteria, and I don't agree with all of his findings, but he did produce an evaluation of presidents. He was impressed by those who stood up to Congress primarily.
Okay, but we're back to the single individual assessing again.
Right.
Now, you don't like, it seems to be, James Varber. At least you say it's the least satisfactory. Why?
Well, in my mind, it is. It's a pseudo-psychological approach that, well, perhaps I should say it's an approach that attempts to use psychological constructs. And it fits presidents into arbitrary categories: active, negative, passive, positive, and so forth. And much of it is questionable. Of course, by the nature of it, many of the presidents fit into these categories with hindsight. And Barber and his successors like to think that they have done a fair job in predicting. For example, he called Lyndon Johnson an active negative, but he described a negative personality as one who really didn't like the presidency and all that, and Johnson gloried in being president. Nixon didn't fit well into his categories.
Okay, so he doesn't necessarily equate active with being positive. It could be an active negative,
right.
Active positive.
Right.
Okay. Charles and Richard Faber, one of the more interesting. Now, that can cut a number of different ways.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not the most skillfully written. It is based on their own personal evaluations. But it's an attempt to be very systematic, and it sets forth a number of criteria against which they measure each president. And the thing that makes it more interesting in my mind is that they do more than just provide a list or a sentence or two regarding each president. They give at least a couple of pages or more of description of how they arrived at their evaluations of each president.
Okay, we've just rattled off a whole bunch of different approaches, different methodology. Did it make any difference in the end? Were the rankings significantly different?
Well, yes and no. At the ends, the rankings tend to be pretty much the same. Almost every survey, every ranking, will come out with Abraham Lincoln on top, and Franklin Roosevelt and George Washington, two or three, or three and two. And most of them will come out with the same culprits at the bottom: Harding, Pierce, Grant, and I take exception to Grant being listed so low, but...
Why do you think the same group, let's just take the top three, no matter what order they come in, Washington, Lincoln, FDR, why do they come in at the top? Is it just the circumstances? Because many have argued that it's the circumstances, the context that makes the president. Washington was first, Lincoln faced a civil war, FDR faced a depression and a world war. is every president ultimately held up against what he needs to deal with during his presidency?
To some extent, that's true. Rossiter remarked that no president can achieve greatness in the absence of a serious crisis. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. pointed out that that often is true. It tends to be true, but Andrew Jackson and Theodore Roosevelt, among the immortals, he said, did do so in the absence of a significant crisis.
Okay. To the best of my knowledge, from what you indicated here, all of these surveys that you've brought up have really relied on experts.
Yes.
Are you aware of, or can you tell us about any surveys that were done among the common people, so to speak?
Yes. Some surveys include common people. There was the Chicago Tribune poll that was a survey of readers. The C-SPAN 2000 poll included who knows whom. But the more they proceed away from professional historians and political scientists, and the more they include a popular audience, the higher some noted figures are likely to be. John Kennedy, for example, will rate very high in a popular audience. Now, I'm not saying John Kennedy was not good, but an American audience tends to be not very sophisticated historically, not to have a great deal of historical knowledge. They may not even be aware that there were two presidents, Roosevelt, or that one was a Republican and one was a Democrat. And they have heard of a few presidents, such as Lincoln and Washington, but they've all heard of Kennedy, and Kennedy with the Camelot aura ranks high in their judgments. But Kennedy was not a great legislative leader. He did have certain great strengths in his presidency, but he was in too short a time, in my estimation, to rank extremely highly.
Clearly, we get an awful lot on John Kennedy, no
right.
question about it. We have another movie even coming out on John and Bobby Kennedy, I understand. And he's clearly higher ranked with the general population. But let me just take you a step further on that. You mentioned that at least in some of these surveys, there is some variation, but it tends to take place in the middle of the pack.
Right.
And you mentioned people like John Quincy Adams. Let's just take him as an example. How does he vary in the polls and why?
Well, Adams can go up and down depending on the criteria with which you approach your evaluation. From a strictly objective point of view, in terms of results, he was a failure. He didn't get anything through, but he proposed an absolutely brilliant program. And the Congress was dominated by Jacksonians and by his enemies, and they laughed him out of Washington almost. He only served one term. And nothing substantial that he proposed, such as observatories and a vast program of internal improvements, roads and bridges and so forth, was adopted. But much of what he proposed did become the foundation for American public policy in decades to come.
Yeah, everything I've read about him is absolutely brilliant, and many people just say him the best prepared failure in American history.
Probably so.
James Buchanan.
James Buchanan, a classic doughface. A doughface is a northern man with southern principles. There's evidence to indicate that he even conspired with Supreme Court justices to bring out the infamous Dred Scott decision, thinking that would settle the slavery question. It didn't.
Okay. Andrew Johnson.
Andrew Johnson. Rossiter rates him well. He had 8 greats and 6 near greats. He ranked him among the near greats because he stood up to Congress. He was stubborn. He was independent. He was courageous. But he was also a rabid racist, and he undercut Reconstruction, leaving Grant with very little to work with in that regard, and Grant nonetheless performed quite well, despite his reputation. Johnson was a classic populist. He came to office wanting to punish the Confederate leaders. He would like to have hanged them. He wanted to hang Robert E. Lee, for example, and Grant stood up to him and as General Grant and said he would resign if he did that, so he backed off. But he was also dedicated to maintaining white supremacy. And in his opinion, white supremacy was more important than his populist principles, and he let it overwhelm his populist instincts, so he let the Confederate leaders come back, take charge. He looked the other way when the Ku Klux Klan, which was a terrorist guerrilla organization, emerged to terrorize the newly freed blacks and also Republicans in the South and make it impossible for the South to develop a two-party system. So his legacy was very detrimental. However, he did come back after he left the presidency and was elected to the United States Senate, the only former president ever to do that, and only one of two to have taken a seat in Congress after he left the office.
Okay. Many people believe, I've often heard it say, an assassin's bullet is the ticket to be highly ranked in the polls, and at least in the popular mind. You mentioned John Kennedy earlier. But when you look back, you think of someone like Garfield, who was also assassinated, doesn't generally appear on the high ranking. So is it a fallacy?
I don't think it's a fallacy. I think that if the conditions are there, an assassination certainly can create an enormous surge of not only popular opinion, but almost creation of a myth. Lincoln, Kennedy. I think certainly Kennedy and perhaps even Lincoln have become the basis of mythology because of assassination, or at least partly because of assassination, in ways that they might not have been able to otherwise. However, as you point out, there is no Garfield myth or McKinley myth, and they were assassinated in office. Nor is there a Harding myth. He wasn't assassinated, but he died in office.
Okay. The strength of your book, it seems to me, is you cover every president, and you spend a great deal of time. It isn't just giving them a ranking and saying, take that.
Right.
But let me ask you, in the few minutes we have left, in your mind, who were the best presidents?
Well, I can reel off a quick dozen chronologically. Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Polk, Lincoln, and Grant, surprisingly. I think Grant's the most underrated of the presidents, and I don't have time to go into that, but I have an article coming out on the subject.
Okay.
Both Roosevelts, Wilson, Truman, LBJ, and this will come as a surprise, perhaps, Bill Clinton. And I say that because I think he saved the presidency by not permitting himself to be forced out of office, which would have, I think, destroyed the efficiency, the effectiveness, the power of the presidency if two presidents had been ousted within roughly a quarter century.
Interesting. Okay, but it's dangerous, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That when we look at someone who is so, he's still alive, still very much active,
right,
that his popular perception, even among the experts, actually may change. We've had examples,
yes,
with Eisenhower and Truman, for
right,
example. But you're willing to take that stand now.
Right. Both Eisenhower and Truman rate much better than they did at one time. And yes, I would take that stand regarding Clinton. He did have some substantial accomplishments. But he, along with Richard Nixon and Abraham Lincoln, and probably Theodore Roosevelt if he'd been tested, but he wasn't tested politically in that way, were the toughest people ever to serve in political office, probably. The iron people who just plugged along no matter what.
A lot of talk about Ronald Reagan, because he just passed away. What do you think?
Yes. Well, talk about mythology. Here we come. You have Grover Norquist wanting his face to be carved on Mount Rushmore, which fortunately is not, I understand, not possible technically. But they renamed Washington's airport for Ronald Reagan, and for goodness sake, it was already named for a president, the father of the country. An aircraft carrier, poor Ronald Reagan, must be spinning in his grave because a big office building full of federal bureaucrats is named for Reagan. Reagan had some substantial accomplishments, and he certainly grew in office. He turned out not to be the ideologue that he appeared to be at first. At least he was an ideologue that was capable of growth. On the other hand, I think he left a pernicious legacy of despising government in general. He came to office in his inaugural address asserting that the solution to the problem is not government, that government was the problem. And it denigrated civil servants, it denigrated America's political system that has been really rather successful over a couple of centuries.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good book and great conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Max Skidmore, author of Presidential Performance, A Comprehensive Review. When we return, Bruce Ackerman comments on the presidential election that pitted John Adams against Thomas Jefferson, but that nearly resulted in neither being elected. This is Talking History. The presidential election of 1800 has long been notorious for both the ferocity of the partisan rancor it produced and the unforeseen constitutional problems it presented. So writes our guest commentator this week, Bruce Ackerman, who also raises the question of whether candidate Thomas Jefferson acted properly in that election as Vice President of the United States and President of the Senate. Ackerman is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University.
Thanks to a blunder at the Constitutional Convention, Thomas Jefferson found himself in an awkward position during the bitterly contested presidential election of 1800. As sitting vice president during the Adams administration, one of Jefferson's jobs was to serve as president of the Senate, and the Constitution gave him the task of opening up the electoral votes from each state and announcing the results. There was only one difficulty. Jefferson himself was running for president, and his rulings from the chair could determine whether he would come out victorious. This, in fact, posed a very serious problem, as my research with my friend David Fontana reveals. We've inspected the original electoral ballots in the National Archives, and we've discovered that the four electoral votes cast by Georgia failed to comply with the explicit requirements laid down by the Constitution. Nevertheless, Jefferson chose to award Georgia's votes to himself and his running mate, Aaron Burr, without publicly announcing the existence of the problem to Congress. This decision could have changed the result. Without Georgia's four votes, Jefferson and Burr would have tied with 69 electoral votes apiece, and this would have thrown them into runoffs in the House of Representatives with the opposing candidates John Adams, Charles Pinckney, and John Jay. But once Georgia's four votes were counted, Jefferson could apply a different constitutional rule, which restricted the House runoff to a two-man race between himself and Aaron Burr. While Jefferson managed to beat Burr on the 36th ballot, he might well have lost to John Adams or Charles Pinckney if they had been allowed to compete in the House runoff. So, did Jefferson do the right thing in counting out his competitors? Our investigation of the Georgia archives reveals that its four electors really did intend to vote for Jefferson and Burr, and that their defective ballot was merely the result of frontier lawyering. So Jefferson's decision did really respect the intention of the voters. This is a key point, since Jefferson's ruling served as an important constitutional precedent. When some future vice president is obliged to make a ruling on a contested ballot, he should recall that Jefferson didn't use his power to thwart the intention of Georgia's electors, but rather tried to enable them to participate fully and fairly in the process of presidential selection.
You've been listening to Bruce Ackerman, Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. Ackerman's commentary is developed further in articles published in the March 2004 issue of the Atlantic Monthly and in the April issue of the Virginia Law Review. When we return, Fiona Beattie tells us about a website packed with historical information on the American presidency. As promised, we conclude this week's program dedicated to the American presidency with Fiona Beattie reporting on a website where you can spend many hours studying the history of the American presidency without leaving the comforts of home.
If you wish to explore the 43 American presidencies in detail, try the comprehensive online resource created by the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. The site originally began as a companion to the PBS American Presidents series in 2000 and since then has grown in size and depth. Under the guidance of leading scholars in the field, the digital collection aims to serve the needs of teachers, students, and the general public. Two primary modules, The Presidency in Action and The Presidency in History, explore the processes involved in presidential decision-making. Hundreds of hours of secret White House recordings from FDR, John F. Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson are available, with the promise of more from Nixon, Truman, and Eisenhower. And if you haven't heard enough, try listening to some of the most significant presidential speeches from the past 70 years. All of this and more is available online at www.americanpresident.org.
That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.